May it please the court. Together with Mr. Jim Parsons, we are pleased to represent the petitioner, Matthews Construction Company versus Harvey Rosen. This is a statute of limitations case. I think that there are a number of reasons why the statute of limitations is not a defense in this case, and I would like to discuss those reasons for you. Before I examine the statute of limitations and the legal arguments, however, I would like to briefly discuss some of the important and material facts which occurred in this case, which I think will help the court in deciding the statute of limitations argument. In 1979, Matthews Construction Company entered into a contract with Houston Pipe and Supply Company. As it would later turn out, Houston Pipe and Supply Company had a dominant stockholder, a Mr. Harvey Rosen, who controlled that corporation. The contract was to remove some pipe from the ground and transport it. Now, before that contract was entered into, Mr. Rosen represented to Mr. Matthews that his corporation, Houston Pipe and Supply Company, did in fact have sufficient assets that it was a financially viable company. Subsequent to the contract, Mr. Rosen announced that the contract was not going to be complied with from the standpoint of Houston Pipe and Supply Company. At that point, Mr. Matthews' lawyers sought an injunction to prevent the sale of the pipe. At that injunction hearing, under oath, Mr. Rosen represented to the court that my company, Houston Pipe and Supply Company, is a viable corporation that has more than enough assets to satisfy any judgment against it. And as a consequence, the injunction was, in fact, dismissed. Discovery proceeded against Houston Pipe and Supply Company. Unknown to Mr. Matthews, Mr. Rosen's attorneys were preparing alter ego and constructive fraud defenses. Also unknown to Mr. Matthews at the time, Mr. Rosen was systematically stripping his corporation, Houston Pipe and Supply Company, of its assets.
This began during the litigation, before the litigation, before the contract. When do you allege, and what does the evidence show when this began?
The evidence at trial, Justice Heck, was that beginning in 1979, and it's a little bit complicated because Mr. Rosen owns several different corporations and tends to, as often happens in these situations, borrow money from the corporations. But in 1979 and up through 1982, various loans, transfers of assets, and various other money was transferred among these corporations. The actual trial testimony was from Mr. Rosen, an admission on the stand, that as of the middle of 1982, Houston Pipe and Supply Company had no physical or tangible assets. So it really was a systematic process that took place perhaps beginning in 1979, but the majority of the activity, and I think the trial record will bear me out, took place in 1981 and 1982. In 1982, in July of 1982, a judgment was signed against Houston Pipe and Supply Company following a jury trial where the trial counsel that represented Matthews Construction Company was Mr. Parsons. In March of 1983, in an attempt to satisfy the judgment to determine what assets Houston Pipe and Supply Company had, for the first time, and the jury found in the second trial, March 12, 1983, that, in fact, Houston Pipe and Supply Company had no assets. At that point, Mr. Matthews decided to proceed directly against Harvey Rosen individually in pursuit of a cause of action both on breach of contract and on constructive fraud. It is clear from the record that Mr. Rosen, unknown to Mr. Matthews, was preparing his alter ego defenses, statute of limitations defenses, long before Mr. Matthews learned of the situation. And it is also clear that unknown to Mr. Matthews, his corporation was being stripped of its assets.
When you say it was being stripped, how were these assets being disposed? Specifically, to whom were they being given or sold?
That is a, in a sense, Justice Doggett, that is a somewhat complicated question. It is answered, I will try to answer that question in a general sense, but the specifics of the transactions that took place between the various corporations are set out in detail in the appendix to our petitioner's brief, our initial petitioner's brief. But in essence, what would happen would be Mr. Rosen, for example, would borrow money from a bank in the name of Houston Pipe and Supply Company, for example, and then he would take that money and he would transfer that money into a bank account, use that bank account to purchase some other asset, and then he would put the title of that asset in the name of either himself or another company. That's one example of the type of transaction that took place. The reason I say that I cannot answer that question fully within this forum is that when I sat down initially to try to figure out what happened when I was writing the Court of Appeals brief, it took me about 3 days to figure out the various complicated financial transactions that occurred between Mr. Rosen. But I think the important point to be made, it comes from the testimony of Mr. Rosen's accountant. Mr. Rosen's accountant testified that there was no basis for these transfers other than to protect Mr. Rosen from his creditors. In other words, there was no legitimate purpose for the transfers of assets that took place among the various corporations. Given those facts, I think that those facts will suggest, as I will argue later on, that there are substantial policy reasons for why the discovery rule applies in this case.
What personal assets were purchased as a result of loans from Houston Pipe and Supply?
Some of the personal assets included things such as mundane as cosmetics, for example, jewelry for members of Mr. Rosen's family. One asset in particular that comes to mind is an airplane. At the original injunction hearing, Mr. Rosen represented that this airline or airplane is a primary asset of Houston Pipe and Supply Company. Well, subsequent to the injunction hearing, the ownership of that airplane was transferred to another corporation. I don't remember the name of that corporation right now, but another corporation where the dominant stockholder was Mr. Rosen. And then that airplane was sold. Another example of what Mr. Rosen would do is that he would borrow money from Houston Pipe and Supply Company. There's one $500,000 loan that's indicated in the record. Borrow money from Houston Pipe and Supply Company on very favorable terms. No interest or a very low interest rate to be paid out over a 20-year period of time, and then would, in effect, default on the loan that he took from his own company. I think that these factual questions are resolved more clearly, and it is my contention that the court does not need to worry about those, because in this instance, the respondent has not challenged any of the jury factual findings, either on a no evidence point or a factual insufficiency point. Those jury findings were simply, number one, that Mr. Rosen was the alter ego of Houston Pipe and Supply Company. Number two, that he did, after the breach of contract, use his corporation as a sham to perpetrate a fraud on Matthews Construction Company. Number three, that using due diligence, he did not discover and could not have discovered the alter ego status of Mr. Rosen until March 12, 1983. And finally, that the actions, and I think where the jury was coming from, at least as far as I can tell from the record, the conscious plan to strip the corporation of its assets and the lawyers preparing, in this instance, defenses before Mr. Matthews even knew what was happening, and that the actions and plan and the design of Mr. Rosen was committed with malice, therefore justifying punitive damages.
When do you contend that Mr. Rosen began to use Houston Pipe and Supply as his alter ego?
As his alter ego? My contention would be that he began to do that in probably mid-1980 up and through 1982. Now, the reason I put those dates down with respect to the alter ego is that the record reflects, and the trial record reflects, that Mr. Rosen always was pretty loose and free with the way he dealt with his various corporations. And so to the Mr. Rosen was never the type of person to follow corporate formalities to the letter. But I think that if I might make this point, if we had sued Harvey Rosen individually back in 1979, I think Mr. Rosen would have had an argument and probably would have made the argument that as of this point, Houston Pipe and Supply Company is a viable corporation. The acts that really reduced Houston Pipe and Supply Company to a shell of a corporation took place beginning really in 1980, accelerated in 1981 to the point to where by 1982 there were no physical assets left.
The jury found that from the execution of the contract, HP&S was a sham to perpetrate a fraud on Matthews.
That's correct.
But do you contend that Rosen operated HP&S as his alter ego before the contract was entered into?
Before the contract was entered into, I think there's some evidence to suggest that he operated as his alter ego. There's not good evidence to suggest that he operated as his alter ego, only evidence to suggest that the corporate formalities were not followed in the technical sense of the word.
And what about as between the contract and the breach?
Between the contract and the breach, there is no evidence in the record reflecting during that, it's about a month period of time, there's no evidence in the record that I recall at this time specifically on that point. I think part of the trouble I have with Justice Heck's question is that I just, quite frankly, don't remember from my own mind what is in the record for that particular month between the signing of the contract and the breach of the contract. I think the point is that the jury reached these various factual findings, and those findings have not been challenged either on a no evidence point or a factual insufficiency point, either in the Court of Appeals or in this court.
My question comes to this. Can you recover against someone who uses an entity, a corporation, as his alter ego at some point in time after whatever it is the corporation is alleged to have done, whatever wrong the corporation is alleged to have done?
Okay. To make sure that I understand the question, if it's talking in terms of alter ego, we've taken the position in our briefs that, and based on the language in Castleberry versus Branscombe, that alter ego is separate and apart from constructive fraud, sham to perpetrate a fraud. My position would be simply this, that when the breach of contract action occurs, and at that point, knowing nothing else, you have a breach of contract action against the corporation. If after that, you later discover that, in fact, that corporation has been operated as an alter ego, and that the corporation really is legally the same as the dominant stockholder, at the point that you discover or learn that fact is when your cause of action for breach of contract accrues against that alter ego.
My question is a little different from that.
Okay.
If a corporation breaches a contract, and at that point in time, it is not operated as an alter ego, and no one disputes that.
Okay.
And at some later point in time, after the breach, and unrelated to the breach, it begins to be operated as an alter ego. Can you have a cause of action at that point against the individual who is thus operating the corporation?
It depends
on the breach that happened earlier.
It depends upon how he operates the corporation. If it is an alter ego that does not affect the plaintiff's rights, and there can be such a circumstance, I can envision such a circumstance, there may not be a cause of action. But if it is operated as an alter ego, in effect, the corporation and the dominant stockholder merge together. That's the concept of alter ego. They become the same person. And so to the extent that you have a cause of action against the corporation, once the corporation and the individual's identity become the same, it would be my contention that, yes, you do have a cause of action against that alter ego for breach of contract. Now, that's not the basis of our contention in this court, but to answer the justice's question, that would be my contention. if the corporation is operated as a sham to perpetrate a fraud against a creditor or a plaintiff? That's another question. And I would submit that that is an independent basis that we have in this instance for setting aside the statute of limitations.
But the distinction I'm trying to draw in my mind is that you are not claiming that Rosen was, in essence, breached the contract because he was, in essence, the entity with whom Matthews contracted because of an alter ego theory. You're claiming that you're not making any claim as to that, the corporation breached, and then at some later point, your recovery against the corporation was hindered because Mr. Rosen was causing its assets to be transferred.
Okay. I'm saying two things. I'm in essence agreeing, I think, with the justice's question. I'm saying that when the corporation and the alter ego become the same person legally, that whatever cause of action you have against the corporation, because that person is acting as the corporation and is using the corporation for his own personal benefit, that then that cause of action, you would then have a cause of action against the individual. But I think in essence I'm agreeing with the justice's characterization of the argument. I'm also saying that when the corporation is used as a sham to perpetrate a fraud, that that is an entirely separate thing and an independent justification, I will contend, for reversing the Court of Appeals opinion in this instance. Turning now to the statute of limitations question, we in effect have three arguments with respect to the statute of limitations. Number one, that the discovery rule applies under these facts. Number two, that the jury findings support constructive fraud, which stands as an independent cause of action which took place after the breach of contract, that no statute of limitations defense was asserted against, and therefore stands as an independent basis for affirming the judgment of the trial court. And third, that under the holding of Gentry, the 1975 Supreme Court case, that suit against the corporation tolls that suit with respect to the alter ego. I'd like to return then to the first point. Does the discovery rule apply in this particular instance? Now last week, this court, in the opinion of Marino, discussed generally what the policy was behind a statute of limitations. And this court noted, as for the Justice Spears, who's not with us today, that the purpose behind the statute of limitations is to require a party to seek, within a reasonable period of time, his cause of action so that the defendant has a reasonable opportunity to defend. That's the stated legislative purpose, and that's been the purpose stated by this court in a number of opinions with respect to the statute of limitations. So did Mr. Rosen have a reasonable opportunity to defend in this instance? I would submit to you that the record is clear that he did. He was the dominant stockholder. He paid the lawyer's fees in the initial suit between Houston Pipe and Supply Company and Matthews Construction Company. He did have more than a fair opportunity to defend, particularly in light of the fact that his lawyers were preparing statute of limitations defenses. In the time remaining to me, I would like to discuss the constructive fraud. The essence of the Court of Appeals opinion in this case depends upon and relies, as does respondent's argument, that a sham to perpetrate a fraud, as defined by this court in Castleberry versus Branscom, is not an independent cause of action, is not an independent basis to support a judgment. I would submit that this court has written on that issue several times. Ballone versus Ballone, for example. International Bankers versus Holloway, where this court treated constructive fraud as an independent cause of action. Justice Spears noted in the Castleberry opinion that, in fact, sham to perpetrate a fraud was separate and apart from alter ego. Since the Castleberry opinion, there have been a number of opinions, primarily out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, Speed, The Speed case, which was a case that where the writ was denied last year, Seaside Industries, Tigret versus Pointer, numerous courts of appeals decisions, with the only exception, in fact, being that I know of, the Court of Appeals in this case, that have treated sham to perpetrator fraud as an independent cause of action.
Doesn't your theory, though, rely upon the premise that a debtor has a duty to preserve his assets for his creditors?
It does, in fact, rely upon that. And that, as a legal question, to my mind, is settled law in the state of Texas. The Tigret case...
I have a good many creditors, and so if I... If knowing that I owed them as much as I do, spent the money on a vacation, conceivably I might be liable for breach of that duty.
I would think that could very well be true. I mean, I would think that if you owe someone money, I think the point that the courts have made, and the best case, it's not an opinion out of this court. It's an opinion by the Dallas Court of Appeals in 1979, but it's the Tigret versus Pointer case, which we cite in our briefs. And they say that if you've got a corporation that owes money to a creditor, and you are the dominant stockholder, you control that corporation's assets, and you control what that corporation does, that you do have a duty to preserve the assets to benefit the creditors. And I think that's been the law in the state of Texas for many, many years.
Does it make any difference to all the creditors? Sort of a tangent to your theory, but if you paid a good many of the assets to one, a favored creditor, and thereby deprived the others of their share?
Well, I think you're talking about priority of interest between creditors, which is an issue that doesn't exist in this case. My understanding would be in a situation like that, that would probably be resolved by application of Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code, for example, some of the bankruptcy statutes that talk about priority. That's not an issue in this case. The only creditor that exists in this case that I know of, although there may be other creditors out there, the only creditor who has been trying to get his money and hasn't got it yet despite two jury verdicts in his favor is Matthews Construction Company. One final point I would like to make.
I have a question. Let me see if I understand your position. You're not really saying that if a closely held corporation has $1 million in assets and has $1 million which it owes to liabilities, that it has an obligation to shut down and cannot conduct business on a day-to-day basis in the ordinary course of business?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Well, you did say they had an obligation to preserve their assets.
What I'm saying is that if you have creditors out there and you are the person who is in control of that corporation, perhaps I didn't understand the Justice's question.
If your assets equal your liabilities, you still have the right to conduct your business in the ordinary course of business. Is that correct?
I would agree with that.
Even though it might jeopardize the position of the outstanding creditors.
I would agree with that. That, of course, is not the fact situation that exists in this particular instance.
I understand. I just wanted to make sure I understood your position.
Okay. My point is that what you cannot do is, for no legitimate purpose, which is the testimony of Mr. Rosen's accountant, transfer assets and strip the corporation of its assets for the purpose of making sure that the creditors don't get the money, which is precisely, I submit, what occurred in this case. One final point on Castleberry versus Branscombe and the independent cause of action of constructive fraud. And that is this whole bit about sham to perpetrator fraud being an independent cause of action appeared fairly recently in the case. For example, trial counsel, not Mr. Kronzer, but trial counsel did not object to the submission of the constructive fraud issue on the basis that it wasn't a cause of action or wasn't some sort of liability. I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you. The court is ready for the argument and will respond. May it please the court, Mr. James Conza will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, and for the record, my name is Jim Cronger. I'm from Houston, and I represent Mr. Harvey Rosen, who I think, unfortunately for him, wended his way into Anderson County had got some home cooking by Mr. Parsons in the original proceeding. I think these things, from the questions the court have rhetorically asked, may be necessary to clear up, if I can. First, it is critical to our position that the court realize that in the Houston pleadings, they allege stripping the trust fund and fraudulent transfer. They, however, did not, they abandoned it, did not seek any findings, and have no findings. The trust fund doctrine, that is the duty of a debtor to keep his assets intact, even if he can continue the operation of his business, requires findings of an intent to defraud and to prevent the creditors from otherwise proceeding. Now, about that, I didn't think until I heard here today that that it can be done on pure alter ego findings. And that's all we have. In addressing ourselves further to that, the issues are, I think, most important to a resolution of the problems. They are set out, of course, in the opinion of a court of appeals and in the briefs of the parties. But it's important to go back to square one. The case in Palestine was a pure breach of contract case against the corporation. And that is all it was. There was no tort connected with it. The jury found, in response to special issue number one, or question one here, that Mr. Rosen was an alter ego of the Houston Pipes and Supply, or that Houston Pipe and Supply was an alter ego of him. And it submitted that under one of the various features announced in Castleberry about how to pierce. And that one was if it results in an injustice by the way and manner in which you keep your books and records. Now, I'm not unmindful of the fact it doesn't do a lot of good to quote what the Court of Civil Appeals has said once you've granted a writ on 8 points and are up here looking cold and hard at it. But I think one thing the court said that has to be accepted as true. There isn't anything wrong per se, vel nomen, with a person operating a corporate entity as his or her alter ego. That's not a case or a cause of action. I mean, people may have tax reasons to do it, other reasons to have the corporate entity, but otherwise operate it purely as their own business. Now, the response to special issue number one does not in and of itself establishing anything other, and apparently Judge Heck, at all material times, that he was the alter ego of the company. It isn't limited to any time after the contract was entered into. Now, question number two, which was not predicated, inquires of the jury whether or not after the execution of the contract, he committed acts which were a sham to perpetrate a fraud on Matthews Construction Company, to which the jury found we do. Now, if the court gives even broad meaning to that issue, it still establishes no more than after the execution of the contract, he engaged in practices that would constitute a sham. That element and that method of submitting piercing is laid out in Castleberry versus Branscombe as one of the reasons to do it. There isn't any suggestion by this court in any case, it's our challenge, that an alter ego becomes a defrauder merely because he operated his business or her business as an alter ego or as one and the same. what is necessary, there be some wrong connected with the, if it's going to be a tort ever, it's got to be something that's wrong. Otherwise, you're just asking another party to be held liable on the breach of contract. All the cases they cite are cases in which there are either fraud findings or there is a fiduciary relationship, which I suppose takes me back full circle to whether there was a fiduciary relationship here. There may have been. That's not before us today. But the trust fund theory, that's what gives rise to one under Tigrit versus Pointer, was not submitted, was abandoned. Fraudulent transfer of assets. And all that was found was ways to get a piercing finding against Mr. Rosen.
You concede then that if a corporation that had one shareholder, in order to avoid paying a judgment, caused assets to be transferred to the shareholder himself or to other entities to the shareholder's benefit so as to hinder payment to the creditor, that might be actionable.
Well, if you're asking generically, Justice Hayes, I would answer that affirmatively, that there is in Texas what's called a trust fund doctrine, and that's in Tigrit versus Pointer in those cases, that a debtor has a duty to use reasonable care of his assets for the benefit of the creditor, as Justice Cook says. He's got a right to continue business if his prospects are reasonable. But that's not found here. That's not contended here. All that is contended, that to operate your business as a sham after the contract's executed. I want to emphasize the after. All that's being suggested here is that's a new cause of action. Whereas a cause of action against an alter ego has never been considered a independent cause of action prior to the arguments in this case. Because I may have something else coming up later behind this, I'm going to be careful about what I say about the impact of a fraudulent joinder when you're really asserting it. I'm going to keep some running room left, but nonetheless, that is not in this case.
The Court of Appeals also suggests that what we have here is essentially just a weighing of competing policy considerations. Do you agree with that?
Well, Justice Doggett, I must say that to talk about Moreno is to me to kind of watch your mother-in-law drive the new Cadillac over the cliff. I see awful portents in that case from my viewpoint in other areas. But I do say that there is no claim that was made and can be dredged out of this record that there was any fraud itself connected with the stripping of assets. The definition of constructive fraud that was used in these issues was taken directly out of Castleberry. And it doesn't have a thing to do with the type of fraud you're talking about when you have an independent action for fraud. If the court holds that the Castleberry piercing mechanism, where no fraud is submitted, constitute independent causes of action, and therefore open the Limitation Act wider, it seems to me that is a serious policy consideration when you consider the number of corporate entities, small businesses, that are operating, seeking the protection of corporate law, and whether he did or not. But that's an awful big policy step. And as you discussed in the Willis versus Maverick case, when we do this, we do it as a class, not selectively for one guy, not as against the other.
Why wasn't fraud finding in question two to the jury sufficient to support recovery?
Well, Judge, let me just answer that. I don't think it's a fraud finding. I think that's a way to pierce the veil and make somebody else liable on the debt. Look at the way that it was defined. Fraud means conduct which has a tendency to deceive others or to injure public interest. That's not fraud.
Sort of a broad
definition. That's constructive fraud, which is sufficient, according to this court in Castleberry, to raise issues to pierce the veil. And he's correct. We have not questioned. There is evidence to support alter ego findings. We have not attacked those findings. But what we do say is that the discovery rule should not apply. That this court in Gentry meant what it said when it said we're not going to treat the period of time in which the prior suit is pending as tolling the statute for all that time and then just add on 4 more years. Now that's in essence what they're arguing about that. But lastly, and back to Moreno, let's assume, it's a hard one, but I'm going to toss it up. Let's assume that there is an independent tort involved in number 2 and 4, because 3, the discovery finding, is not related to number 2. All at number 3, the discovery finding, asked was with respect to the first issue, the alter ego finding, not to the sham. So let's assume it was one. Now, if there's anything that Moreno makes clear, it is that even in statutes which do not fix the date of accrual, that you must still look for when did the cause of action accrue. And you cite in that opinion cases that very clearly say that for purposes of an action of this type, when would the cause of action arise? A person doesn't have to discover that he has a case or even the person that he might see under Moreno. That's exactly what the court said. And I'm not holding briefs with the rest of it. I'm just talking about that feature of it. And as to that there is no basis to suggest that the injury in this case was any other date than the breach of contract date. Under Moreno, that is clear, the cases you cite and rely on. So whichever way you turn, even if discovery was applicable, it still would have been barred by the time the suit was filed, because the injury itself, the loss, the damages resulting from the alleged breach, occurred in the cause of action accrued in 79, when that event occurred.
If there were a breach, yes, and a trial and a judgment and an appeal, and all of that took more than 4 years, and during the appeal, the sole shareholder of the defendant corporation decided he was probably going to lose, and at that point began to transfer assets of the corporation to keep from paying the judgment, wouldn't an action for that wrong accrue at the time that he began to do that, or if the discovery rule applies, whenever he discovered it? But at least it wouldn't accrue until the shareholder began to transfer the assets at this later period of time.
Again, I know I don't have any business being guarded about some other people I represent, but I can say this, that there is an accrual under Moreno itself in the cases you cite when the injury occurs. Now, if we want to go back to stripping of assets, denuding assets, transfer in violation of the Fraudulent Transfer Act, you're talking about another breed of cats. And that's not here. That's what seems to me to be so critically important about the distinction between what they're trying to sell here and what might be the case in a fraudulent transfer or a true trust fund stripping of assets case. And believe me, this record shows abandonment of those concepts. And all they're trying to do is extrapolate a finding that he operated it as a sham or a fraud, defining fraud to be constructive fraud. If an independent cause of action from the breach of contract action itself. Even if it were so, there's no finding that he began this after the judgment itself was procured in the prior action. And there's, but again, I come back, if we do have an independent tort, that independent tort, the injury arises when the breach occurs. And under any concept, the statute should apply. I think I only have this additional thing to say about expanding the discovery rule. I'm mindful that in a sense it has been restricted in those cases in which the statute itself sets an absolute date when the cause of action arises. But in those cases where you have to ascertain when it accrued, which is a court inquiry function, in those cases, which this one, this statute, the four-year statute, does not set a date when it accrues, but you have established previously too, but in Moreno, that it, that doesn't depend on you knowing who it was. Article 1, Section 13 of the Constitution doesn't depend on that. It depends only on impossibility, you said. And that the injury is the time. In this case, the only injury that they ever sustained was that of the transfer or stripping of assets about which there are no findings. And there is not a question of presuming findings or anything about that, because you can't presume or deem a finding to where there's nothing referable to it, and that would be the case. So as I sit down, let me just say, if the court holds that the Castleberry causes or methods of piercing create independent causes of action in and of themselves without any fiduciary relationship that's found, then it seems to me we really, the court really will have opened up a Pandora's box in cases involving corporate entities that are properly organized or properly doing business. And if that's all it takes, is that they operated as a sham to perpetrate a constructive fraud, and that's a new case, new cause of action, then so be it. You have that power. I know that. But the real bottom line question, if you do that, when did it accrue? When did that cause of action accrue? It occurred when the injury occurred, and that was in 79. And finally, just to say, we have argued the question of whether or not they can say, having filed a suit in Anderson County, that that would toll the statute, because you did develop an exception of a sort in that case. You held it an alter ego in that case. You held that an alter ego could be brought into the litigation more than 4 years or 2 years, as the case may be, after the injury occurred, even though he would otherwise be barred by the statute. The court, in footnote 2, in Gentry, said, we are not saying here that this would apply to people not brought in before the final judgment. We say not, 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 it's not just dicta or a portent. How else could it be, unless you want to say in every case in which a suit is brought against some corporate entity, that the statute of limitations is told for the entire time that case is pending and 4 years thereafter. And so it is, we believe the court should affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals and otherwise give us the maximum relief to which we're entitled. Is there any other?
Mr. Cross, I have a question that's not related to anything
that's
been argued here. I'm just curious. The Castleberry versus Branscombe was on the losing side, and it was a 5-4 opinion, and there was some talk about the legislature changing what we wrote in Castleberry versus Branscombe. Are you familiar with that effort, and
yes.
You know how far it got?
Yes, I am. The legislature did change it, as you know. But not so it would be applicable to this case. They have changed it to where you can't set aside the corporate entity if, in fact, it has continued to exist and there's no independent fraud or anything else practiced with it.
Why would that legislation not apply to this case? Because
I'd like to say it would, Judge, but I think it has a provision. It only applies to
cause of action because of time sequence when the case arises. Okay.
Thank you.
Since we're satisfying our curiosities, I see that Mr. Laxton is shown in the reporter as counsel for Matthews, and on the briefs is counsel for Rosen. Is that a misprint?
That is another one of my not error-free mistakes. Mr. Laxton has always represented Mr. Rosen, and still does. Thank you for your audience, and Mr.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. The reference to Pandora's box, I think, is an interesting one because, of course, by legend, Pandora's box opened up evils to the world. One of the evils that this court has talked about on occasion is unnecessary litigation, unnecessary discovery. What message would be sent to the bar if this court were to say that you, as a corporation, can represent in open court, that your corporation can satisfy any judgment against it, and then, unknown to the plaintiff, strip that corporation of its assets, prepare your alter ego defenses, wait until a judgment occurs, delay the appellate process, as occurred in this case, delay the appellate process, and then claim the statute of limitations. The message will be simple. As a plaintiff's lawyer, to prevent any possibility of legal malpractice, I've got to sue every person connected with that corporation, whether or not I believe that there is a good faith reason to do so. And I've got to conduct an extensive discovery in the primary case to determine what the corporation is. In
Mr.
effect,
Cronzer just says that you didn't ask the right questions at trial.
Well,
that's a thrust of his argument, not that there is no way that a careful attorney can preserve that asset.
I agree that that's Mr. Cronzer's argument. I don't think that the argument has any merit, Justice Phillips. Sure, I'll be happy to. One thing that Mr. Cronzer talks about is he talks about the trust fund theory. The trust fund theory is put another way, and I think there's a little bit of a semantic difference here between Mr. Cronzer's argument and my argument. But the trust fund theory has been articulated in a number of cases. The trust fund theory has been used interchangeably with the term constructive fraud. One case that's instructive on that is International Bankers versus Holloway. Constructive fraud is, in its essence, an equitable cause of action created to take care of an unjust result. And in Castleberry versus Branscombe, this court, in effect, used the trust fund doctrine by using constructive fraud. So I submit to the court that when we submitted question number 2 to the jury, we were doing precisely what we had been told to do by the Texas Supreme Court.
Where did you get the definition of fraud that you used in the issue?
From the Castleberry opinion. That definition of fraud is directly from the Castleberry opinion. In fact, it is a direct quote from the Castleberry opinion, the only difference being the language concerning duty, which is omitted. I submit to the court, and I too, given some of the clients that I represent, do not want this opinion to come back and haunt me. We are not suggesting to the court that every vehicle for piercing the corporate veil creates a cause of action. We are not suggesting to the court that alter ego standing in and of itself, absent some other wrong, is a cause of action. We are submitting that this case can be found in favor of the plaintiff and petitioner based upon existing law. There are cases in this court, in this state, that have applied the discovery rule in contract cases. Castleberry v. Branscombe. We're not asking the court to expand Castleberry v. Branscombe. We're asking the court to apply Castleberry v. Branscombe in this case, as the Dallas court did in the Speed case, which was writ denied by this court, and the Seaside Industries cases. I urge the court to look at those Court of Appeals opinions, because although the statute of limitations is not a question in those cases, constructive fraud as defined by Castleberry was used in those decisions to support a judgment independent of any other cause of action.
There doesn't appear to be any briefing concerning what other states do with reference to the discovery rule in this kind of study. Do you have any?
Judge Dockett, as a matter of fact, I anticipated that question this morning over breakfast. We did look at the Gentry question, the tolling question in the trial court, and we found that a number of jurisdictions, two that come to mind are California and Pennsylvania, have applied the Gentry rule that says that once you sue the corporation, you can toll the statute as long as you've got that suit pending. As far as the discovery rule question in other states and other jurisdictions, quite frankly, given the history of the discovery rule in the state of Texas, the task of finding comparable cases discussing the discovery rule within the same context as Texas law is somewhat a frightening prospect to me. Of course, I'll be happy to undertake that task and submit a brief on what has been done in the discovery rule context in other states. I would point out that in this case, it wasn't just country cooking in Anderson County. There was also a jury trial in Houston County. In Harris County, where Houston is. There was a trial in Harris County, and I don't think there was any Houston cooking. What I think happened is that 12 jurors heard the evidence, heard the admissions from Mr. Rosen's accountant that his business transactions had no legitimate business justification, heard the testimony and admissions from Mr. Rosen that he did not feel the need to tell Mr. Matthews that he was stripping his corporation of his assets, despite the fact that he had represented contrary to Mr. Matthews.
Your argument with respect to questions one and two is, in essence, that these questions establish a form of liability that is either identical to or similar to fraudulent transfer and the trust fund theory.
I think that's correct. I think that the trust fund theory, and part of the difficulty is, Justice Hecht, as I'm sure the Justice knows, when you get into areas of constructive fraud, terms tend to be used interchangeably. But in my research of the constructive fraud issue, which I think was briefed probably more extensively in the Court of Appeals, I discovered that trust fund theory, and we're talking about a common law concept as opposed to the statutory cause of action, which is the Fraudulent Transfer Act. The common law concept of the trust fund theory as articulated in International Bankers versus Holloway, discussed by this court in the Tony Vallone case in 1982 and other cases before this court, that the trust fund theory is used interchangeably with constructive fraud. And when we have jury findings that say after the execution of the contract, the corporation was used as a sham to perpetrate a fraud on Mr. Matthews. You have all that is necessary for a cause of action. You have a duty, you have a breach of the duty, and you have damages. And that is, after all, what a cause of action is. And that's how Castleberry treats it, and that's how all the other courts, except for the Court of Appeals, have treated it in this case.
Mr. Mitchell, let me ask you a question. Your time is about to run out. I understand your argument that you stand on Castleberry v. Branscombe as dispositive of this case in your favor. But is Castleberry v. Branscombe still good law for other cases I didn't, if there's something in the brief about the changes the legislature made, okay. I overlooked it.
You know, quite frankly, and to be honest with you, Judge Justice Gonzales, I'm not sure what statutory provision that's a reference to. I'll accept for the time being that whatever the statutory reference is, that it doesn't apply to my case. I will be happy to look into that and submit a supplemental brief on that issue. Wherefore, premises considered, I would respectfully submit that a situation where two juries, 24 people, both in Anderson County and in Harris County, who have found that Mr. Matthews and his construction company is deserving of the money that they thought they were going to get in 1979. I submit to this court that the equities of this case, that the justice and reason, as this court discussed in Woods versus Mercer and other discovery rule cases, that justice and reason dictate only one result in this case, a result that will not, contrary to Mr. Kronz's assertion, open the floodgates to litigation, but based upon existing law, require that the trial court judgment that was rendered by Judge Sondak be in fact affirmed and the Court of Appeals judgment reversed. I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take a brief recess.
Please rise.